Hello, and welcome to I Am the Eggpot with me, Chris Shaw. The Eggpots take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a welcome return to comedy writer and one half of the excellent Rule of Three podcast, Joel Morris.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Nice to not quite be here.
I know. I should say award-winning podcast.
Yeah, it won a gong, which is nice. It won Best Arts Podcast, which is really funny because it means you're up against things like Somerset House and sort of galleries and stuff about classical music. And it's funny because it's just stuff about old comedy. So yeah, I can now say that old comedy is art, which is nice, or at least culture.
Absolutely. Yeah. We were saying before recording this, there are a few in the pipeline.
No, it stopped because it was lockdown, and part of the fun of it was always getting together. And I've done sort of remote podcasting and things like that. Part of the fun of it was getting together with old friends. And while everyone's been busy doing other stuff, we sort of put it on hold. Also, there's whatever it is, 80 episodes, and people occasionally email or tweet or whatever and say, "Hey, I've just found one I didn't know was there." And I'm going, "Yeah, that's what lockdown was for. Dig down and find the ones you missed." So yeah, there's a big archive. Go and ruffle in that. There's stuff in there. There's gold in those hills.
So the album that you've picked today is George Harrison's 1973 album, Living in the Material World. So why did you pick this one?
I love this record, and I didn't expect it. It's quite a recent arrival in my life, last 4 or 5 years. And I'm a huge Beatles fan, and I thought I knew the Beatles. I thought I knew what you needed to know about solo Beatles, which is mainly sort of, there's a few John Lennon albums. There's probably a Ringo Starr album you should know. And there was All Things Must Pass. And there was a little raft of Macca that was worth getting into if you're a Beatles head and knowing. And so I'd completely overlooked this. I didn't know it existed. I think I'd seen the cover in record fairs of loads of old George Harrison records. And all I knew of George Harrison was the later stuff, sort of Wilbury's era from when I was a kid. And All Things Must Pass, which is the big serious breakup record with all the work, all the songs he was working on when Beatles were breaking up. And my brother, who is a good record head and lives out in Berlin and works, amongst other jobs, he works pricing up vinyl for record shops. So he's a big record nerd.
Oh.
And so he occasionally comes through with I've just found this and this is a really good tip. And he said, "This is a great record and I'd never heard it or heard of it." And he recommended it to me. I think he may have played me a couple of tracks when I was visiting him in Berlin. And it's brilliant. It's just brilliant. It's such a lovely record. And it's a forgotten classic, I think. And slowly it snuck up on me, as George's music does a lot. I think it's not immediately in your face sometimes. And it snuck up on me. And I think this is now my favourite solo Beatle record by quite a long way. It's overtaken Ram and Band on the Run and things. Wow. This is the record I reach for comfort and succour and for a bit, what Mark Lewisohn called, a bit more Beatles. If you want a bit more Beatles, if you listen to all your Beatles and you want some more, this is the one I reach for, because there's something about it that the other post-breakup Beatles records don't have. And a few critics have identified this, is that George is holding on to some of the darkness and the mystery and the mysticism that made the Beatles great. And I don't think Paul and Ringo and John were that interested in that. And oddly, this holds something a bit White Album in it that I don't think many other Beatles solo records have got. So if you're after a bit more sort of side three of the White Album, this is the one.
It is. So the album, it was released in June 1973 and originally titled The Light That Lightened the World. So it's recorded at Apple Studios, although Klaus Voormann later claimed there were some sessions at George's Friar Park Studios. But the backstory, after spending pretty well much of 1972 in legal battles, primarily the litigation brought by Paul McCartney to dissolve the Beatles partnership, and he's also editing the film of Concert for Bangladesh, George began the recording sessions for the follow-up to All Things Must Pass in October 72, and eventually finishing in March 73. And there was also one track rebooted from February 71. And initially, George was continuing to work with Phil Spector, as he had done on All Things Must Pass, but pretty soon Phil's erratic behaviour was all too much, pardon the pun. So George produced it himself. And I think the George production does have a big impact, I think, after the normative All Things Must Pass.
I think that's key to what I love about it. Apart from the fact it's got some nice songs on it and I like the sentiment of it. It sounds beautiful. It sounds really good. And I have a confession to it. I don't have. I'm a big vinyl collector. I've collected all my... I don't have All Things Must Pass on vinyl because I don't like it enough. I find the Phil Spector production a huge barrier to enjoying it. It's three albums long. It's bombastic. It's huge. It's all the stuff I don't really like about rock music. In one thing, it's very guitar heavy. It's very, 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 very priapic and masculine and dominant. It's got... This is a very delicate, almost feminine record for a rock, for a 70s rock man's record. It's very, very acoustic guitar driven, very, very laid back, full of harmonics and tiny pings and very delicate recordings. It's far more George Martin-y in its production. It's very, very close mic'd.
Yeah.
It's very intimate. It's more beautiful. And where I get the feeling that All Things Must Pass is, it's got some... The songwriting on All Things Must Pass is exceptional, but everything is blown up. It's filled with air and rusk and bread and water and pumped up to a size it doesn't deserve. And this has got the opposite thing. It's got some very delicate songs on it, which are allowed to be really small and very internal. And it's about George's mind and his spirit and the inside of him. And it would be wrong for it to be big and bombastic. It's a home record. And he says it's recorded at Apple Studios. I think he's trying to sell session time at Apple Studio. It does sound like it's been recorded at home. I think Klaus is probably telling the truth. It sounds like a home recording. There's something very, very in common with maybe later songwriters like Elliott Smith or someone like that. It's got that sort of at-home indiness about it. It's there's not a lot of electric guitar in it, but where there is, it's slide. Most of it is acoustics. It's a man at home thinking to himself. And I think the lack of Phil Spector is one of the best things about it. And I can say that now he's dead and we all went hot. Well, it's right. I think that Phil Spector did some really bad things and went to prison for some of them, but he didn't go to prison for All Things Must Pass, and that's an oversight because he wrecked that record for me. I think there's something nasty and weirdly, because George was doing loads of coke at the time. There's something very cocaine-y, very, very excessive about All Things Must Pass. And this is much more, feels a bit weed and dopey and far more White Album-y.
Yeah, it's got, if you think of All Things Must Pass, this is kind of not a hangover, but a couple of days after a hangover where you've got time to reflect and...
Yeah. What this has got for me, one of the things, I wrote this down again and again, and I'm going to keep saying it when we go through the songs, actually, hopefully. I'm a massive Nielsen fan. I'm a huge Nielsen fan. Mm. And what Nielsen is for me is the front cover of Nielsen Schmilsen, of him out of focus, in the dressing gown, walking away from the fridge at 3 a.m. And that's what his band sounds like, and that's what his records sound like. He's a hungover man, full of regret and thoughts, at 4 a.m, thinking about the world. And this is not only... got that acoustically, and interestingly, George had been with all the Beatles are with Harry all the time, but he'd been, I think one of the last things he'd recorded around this time was he'd worked on the Son of Schmilsen sessions and been hanging out playing on You're Breaking My Heart, so he'd been hanging out with Harry and in that thing, and he's got Harry's band, he's got Klaus Voormann, and he's got Jim Keltner, and he's got Ringo Starr and everyone who played with him, and this has got the feel, that lovely laid-back 70s, a bunch of hairy mates hanging out feel that is in those lovely Nielsen records. And also, because George crosses over with comedy, in the feel of a lot of those records around the handmade sort of scene around Neil Innes and things, it feels like a comedy record. And growing up, George was always part of Python for me. He was always part of Time Bandits and part of that. And this feels like the record that belongs to... Neil Innes and Rutland Weekend Television and the Ruttles. It's got that vibe. It's a very, very happy, not a funny record, but a warm bunch of friends having a nice time record. And I think some of the session players said they'd been on Lennon's records as well and said the atmosphere was so different. It was so much friendlier, so much more calm. And it's, there's a sense of sadness and melancholy. It's not a happy, upbeat record in lots of places, but it's warm and friendly and I think they're having a nice time. They're enjoying each other's company. And it feels a bit hungover. A bunch of guys with hangovers playing music, not too loudly. And again, not Phil Spector, not bombastic, intimate and delicate. Yeah. It's lovely.
I mean, this followed, obviously, the huge success of All Things Must Pass and the concert for Bangladesh.
Yeah.
And you forget, between the two of those, that's six pieces of vinyl that George has produced in a couple of years. So there was a huge amount of anticipation for this album. And in the US, it hit number one in the Billboard charts, actually knocked Paul's Red Road Speedway off. But at the time, there's a weird juxtaposition of the Beatles pressing ahead with their solo careers. The July 1973 UK album charts, bear in mind they're competing with things like Dark Side of the Moon, Aladdin Sane, Transformer is there. So number 15 is Wings' Red Road Speedway. Number 8 is the Beatles' 1962 to 1966. Number 7 is the Beatles' 1967 to 1970. And number 2 is Living in the Material World.
Wow.
So the anticipation was huge. People went out and bought it. But I think then the critics started kicking in, saying, and there's been lots of accusations that it's quite a dour album.
Yeah, but what it is, it is the hangover record. But it's not just the hangover for the night before, it's the hangover for the Beatles. This is the record that really, really sounds... Lennon sounds angry after the Beatles. He sounds raw and open. Macca sounds playful. He's escaped. He's finally away from this thing that's a burden for him. And he's being very, very playful and silly and fun. And Ram is a fun record, but it's him with his wife and he's happy. This is a man who is sitting in his massive, stupid house. Colossal. He's a man with loads of sports cars and a massive house and loads of money going, I'm going to be spiritual now and not deal with the material world. So he's in a weird place anyway. But he's there and he's probably hearing almost constantly, when are you guys getting back together again? Hey, why did you stop? What went wrong? What went wrong? And he wants to say, and he says in this record, really articulately for a man who's sometimes lyrically not the hottest amongst the Beatles, really articulately he says, it wasn't what you think. It wasn't as easy as you think. I've stopped now, and I stopped now for a reason, because it wasn't fun and it was painful, and we've stopped. And now I'm going to move on. And can you let that be in the past? And I want to be me. And I want some peace and quiet. And I want to get over the echoes, the deafness from the screaming. And the screaming stopped. And I want to go and do something different. So he does things like organises a charity concert. The first charity concert. The pre-Live Aid. The one that gave us the idea for Live Aid. He does that. And then he gives all the money from this record to his charitable foundation for those causes. He says, there's a different way of doing this. This is a record that says, I have had everything that anyone in my job would ever want. I've got all the riches, all the women, all the cars, the drugs, and, I'm tired. He's exhausted. And so when people say it's a doer record, it plods occasionally, it's pretty mid-paced, but he's tired. And again, I like that because it's a sort of schlubby Nielsen-y pace. It's a 3 a.m. in your dressing gown feel. And I really like that sound. It's in Jerry Rafferty and in mid-period Fleetwood Mac, because that sort of shambling hangover rock I'm a big fan of.
Yeah. For this album, he set up the Material World Charitable Foundation, which sponsors, quote, diverse forms of expression and encourages the exploration of alternative life views and helps those with special needs. But basically, he's recorded 2 consecutive albums that were all the money went to charity.
Yeah.
Or he hoped it would.
It's probably, knowing George...
Who else was doing that?
Knowing George, it's almost certainly a tax dodge. I was thinking, obviously, I really like George. I like George as a person. I think he's very, very interesting. But I love the idea that he's both things. He's both this incredibly spiritual, very, very intelligent, questing man, and also a man who wants to keep all his money, please. And people sort of talk about him and say, wasn't it great that he invested in those films? And you went... People invest in films as tax dodges. He's literally the man who keeps writing songs about how he doesn't want to pay tax. Who else is going to pay millions of pounds to make Life of Brian? I love the both sides of him. But this is definitely an example of rock star philanthropy at a time when that was a sort of new idea. Before there was relentless Bono and Chris Martin and the idea that you should do good. That before Michael Stipe's taking Greenpeace on tour with him. This is the birth of that idiom of the caring rock star, or the rock star who wants to do more than just take the money and the drugs. So it's a really interesting record. It's unique. No one else recorded a record about the come down from the Beatles. And this is a record about the come down, the emptiness, the search for something bigger afterwards. That lyrically, it's really interesting, I think. I mean, I don't really listen to the lyrics much. You just get a feel of them. It's such a nice sounding record. But all of it comes together, the lyrics and the snatches of lyric you hear and the instrumentation and things, to say, I'm tired and Is There Anything Else? It's a lovely place to set a record, I think.
Just looking at my notes, 12th of November 1972, in Friar Park, George begins drilling a 200-foot hole in a quest to find 500,000 gallons of water for his ornamental lakes. I was going to do a whole timeline, but I thought,
oh, no,
just that.
That's all you need. He's living in this astonishing camp folly called Friar Park, isn't he? It's just this mad thing that's got sort of punning statues and things. It's sort of comedy location. He's in Rawlinson End, basically. He's in this mad lunatic's folly. And he's there, and he's hiding away. And it's the ideal place to end up. And it sort of seems very, very appropriate. What's odd, I think, is that he then, in that place, makes a record that's as austere in places as this and as intimate. There's a pacing to the songs in this record that is mid-pace, that is walking pace. It feels very easy. And I was watching the documentary, Scorsese's documentary put together, Living in the Material World. And everyone talks about whenever you went to meet George, he was pottering around the place carrying a guitar or a ukulele. And he'd often hand you a ukulele or a guitar and join him. And this whole song appears to have been written while walking around the grounds with a guitar.
Yeah.
And it's just at that pace, four chords over four bars, feet falling and busking chords, very often quite simple things, big open A's and E's and D's. It's the kind of song, the kind of songs you could teach a friend and then meander about your grounds and your well and your lakes. And again, that sort of come over, let's play some guitars together. It's an attempt sort of to get back, to go back to what it was like busking round at Paul's house. They're busker songs. They're wooden school fate skiffle songs, but writ huge rock star baroque. The kind of thing you do while wandering around the biggest house in the world.
So should we crack on with the album then? So we start with side one, track one, which was the first song to be recorded for the album. It's Give Me Love, Give Me Peace on Earth.
Oh, it's lovely. I mean, what it does is it opens up. This is a very reassuring song to start with because it's built over the My Sweet Lord template. It's a nice... Yeah. It opens up, you hear some strummed guitar, nice simple chords, and a slide guitar comes at the top of it, and you go, oh, good, more of that. And then lyrically, it's a sort of mantra. It's sort of a wish for peace and love. Mm. And it's basically a little cousin to My Sweet Lord, but it's a beautiful song. And again, it feels like you're walking around his grounds. It's about that pace.
Yeah.
Open chords, very generous. The same thing that makes Here Comes the Sun work. It's those big, open busker's chords. And what's lovely about George is he's a rock star. He's a 70s rock star with all the nasty crap that could be attached to that. But I think because his mate's Eric Clapton and Eric Clapton's got sewn up bombastic blues bore as a job, George doesn't go near it and isn't very grand or showy offy. He's a busker.
No.
He's basically still on the top of the bus playing nice open Eddie Cochran chords to impress his mates. He's not flashy, and he's a good guitarist. And that's the other thing. There's no guest guitarist on this record. It's all George. This is him stepping out of the shadow of when he does a guitar big rock number on the White Album. He gets his mate in because I can't quite do this. And one of the lovely things about the Beatles is Macca's a world class bass player, but I don't think Ringo is a terrific drummer. But none of them are, in inverted commas, world class. They are. It's not a super group. They're not Cream. They're all really good musicians, but they're not. It's not like putting Led Zeppelin together. They're not sessioners. They are all mates who can play. And George is the lead guitarist in a band that's all about the group, not about the lead guitarist. In an era when the lead guitarist is King and it's Peter Frampton, it's Jeff Beck and it's Eric Clapton.
Yes.
And here he's got a record where it's just him. I said, what do you want to play? Textures? And it's slightly Johnny Marr-ish. He doesn't want to be a guitar hero. He wants to do textures and production. And a lot of that production is just, I'm going to busk on an acoustic guitar. And this is, it's such a beautiful song. So beautiful.
I think you said before, the capo, I think it's on the third fret, but as soon as George gets a capo on an acoustic guitar, something happens.
Yeah.
The natural progression, which ultimately would be the ukulele.
Yeah.
When you couldn't get the capo any higher.
He likes going up high, and he likes the sound of a big open-corded acoustic guitar against one with a capo on. And there were a lot of people producing in that similar style. Cat Stevens is what this album sounds like. It sounds very like Paul Samuel Smith's production of Cat Stevens during the sort of Tillerman era. It's like the spirituality, the references to God, the sort of primary school hymn feel to a lot of the stuff that's on this. And then he gets Nicky Hopkins playing piano over the top of capoed acoustic guitars, and it's got a real Morning Has Broken, Cat Stevens-y, another lovely sound from that era. And I think this is just... It's what's weird is that there aren't any other Beatles records that sound like this. Actually, apart from maybe really recent Macca, or when... Actually, maybe Macca 1 has got that sort of intimacy to it. The first McCartney album. I love the intimacy of this, and it shares that with Cat Stevens or something. It's a proper singer-songwriter, 70s singer-songwriter record.
Yeah. It's the same group of people. I think somebody called them before the solo Beatles family. So you've got Nicky Hopkins, who's sort of flitting from George... John albums, same with Gary Wright, Klaus, obviously, and Jim Keltner as well.
Jim Keltner is the best drummer in the world, except for Ringo. And I genuinely, when the two of them are on an album together, which they are with Nilsson a lot, that's the best sound ever. Jim Keltner, I think, has just been on so many good records. They are, if you're a songwriter and you are, especially like George, and you sort of occasionally drop into triplets or whatever, as part of your songwriting technique, you want a drummer who will just follow you down, who'll follow the vocal melody. And Jim Keltner on this record is just the dream buskers drummer. I mean, it's not like a Paul Simon, Steve Gadd, showy off buskers drummer, but it's just the most astonishing. He's the guy you want who will be listening to your song. He won't be off on his own head thumping away. He'll be, again, it's delicate. And there's some thudding big noise on this record, but it's delicately played.
The big thing about this, obviously, things weren't going too well at home with Patty. Also, you've got George's devotion to Hindu spirituality. And a lot of the album is that theme, isn't it? There's the juxtaposition of secular against, or the material world against spiritual world. And he does sound like he's, not too much on this one, but on a lot of them, he does sound like he's really struggling with that.
Yeah, I think he's... He likes his fast cars and his women. He's an incredibly materialistic guy. I think that's why he's interesting. Is he's very lectury and censorious occasionally, but he struggled with this. He's in this preposterous pile. He's had everything in this career. He's had more fame and power and money and possessions than you could ever want. So he's been through that. Aged about 24, he was fed up with it. Or at least aware that it didn't necessarily make you happy. So it's a sort of, if you're going to listen to anyone, listen to someone who's literally had all the money in the world and then gone, ugh, wasn't enough.
And obviously you've got George singing Om in chorus.
Yeah, it's a My Sweet Lord 2. And I think that a lot of the time when someone's sort of wandering back into the territory with a hit before to try and have a hit, and this was a big hit, it seems cynical or whatever. Yeah. This actually just feels like more of the same. It's he's good at this. He's really good at simplicity. Again, growing up, when he had a hit with Got My Mind Set On You, there's no dumber, simpler song. He likes a bit of bubblegum. He's not afraid of a bit of bubblegum. He understands the roots of it, and I like that. I like that about all the Beatles, actually. They're always unafraid of doing something really simple.
And similar to the album, this in the US knocked Paul's My Love off the top spot. So well done, George. You say So we move on to track two, Sue Me, Sue You Blues.
Yeah, you're going to get one of those from George, aren't you? George hates Blue Meanies. He hates the Blue Meanies. He still hates the Blue Meanies.
He does.
There's two things that are great about this. One, it's another Blue Meanie song. It's another Taxman, Piggies. It's a George versus the guys with the suits and the paperwork, which is always good.
Yeah.
Another thing that's brilliant about it is it's not a blues, because I don't really like rock's flirtation with blues authenticity. And when you see something called Sue Me, Sue You Blues, you go, oh, I know what it's going to be like. Oh, God, it's going to be one. And it isn't. It's jaunty and light. Yeah. It's not ponderous. It's got loads of melodic tricks in it. It plays loads of games with stuff. It's playful and not plodding. It's a blues like For You Blue is a blues, or Old Brown Shoe is a blues. It's a fun, clever one.
As you say, there's a definite theme throughout his career.
Northern song. He shouts about paperwork all the time.
Yeah. Not guilty. I could go on. There's also one he co-wrote with David Bromberg called The Hold Up. I don't know if you've heard that. No. It's basically rewritten Taxman.
So hand us the money, don't stand there and shiver. Tax time is coming, give alms to the poor. Or I'll put a bullet right through your best liver. Wealth is disease and I am the cure. I am the cure, I am the cure, I am the cure.
So throughout his career, and I think somebody was on before who knew somebody who knew solo Beatles, was saying that it was... Even right to the end, a lot of the conversations tended to revolve around finances.
Well, didn't he when he realised he was going to die of cancer, he moved to Switzerland, which is like something from the Ruttles, like spending a year dead as a tax dodge. He literally, even though it was life and death, he was going, right, okay, where's the furthest I can go away? How much can I take with me? Which is really strange for someone to be preparing for death all his life and spiritually, then go, but also, let's have the paperwork sorted for this. Let's make sure no one can get a penny. It's mad. But I was thinking about this and thinking, it's possible to go, God, George, give it a rest. You did very well out of being a pop star. But I think this is more about the Beatles as a gang of kids. And it's the kids versus the grown-ups. And there's a real feeling, especially in 73 when their Alan Klein paperwork's coming through and McCartney's writs are coming through, that the gang's been spoilt by the grown-ups. The fun gang, the Wooden School Fake gang has been spoilt. And he wants to say, I don't want all this grown-up nonsense in the middle of my play park where I've gone off to hide. And so he's got these lovely phrases in it, like joint to scrow and affidavit, and it's full of all this legalese, which weirdly, when you're writing a song, you want new language, you want to have words to play with, and the legalese in this is full of lovely syllables that you can it's good lyrics. It's really fun.
They all went through it, all four of them went through a lot of legal stuff. But I mean, there's stories also of George actually sued Ringo quite late about a production problem.
Yeah, they're on Parkinson's thing being interviewed about this, and they sued each other, and it's like pure Michael Palin and the Ruttles. It became extraordinarily litigious. It's that, and this is actually what's nice about it, this is a song about that, and of course there's You Never Give Me Your Money and things. It was quite a good area for the Beatles to write about, because they felt it must feel so terrible to have your childhood dreams reduced to bank statements and things. But this is a good one. And I tell you, it's a lot nicer to have a go at the men with the suits and the money rather than How Do You Sleep, where you're having a go at each other. I'd much rather listen to this and them saying, why are these guys spoiling it? And why have you... And you're just paying... And the lyric says that, why are you paying these guys? You're paying their bills. They're just taking the money. The more we do this to each other, the more they're taking the money away. And that lovely line, the only thing you've got to do is find a new band. And the idea that whatever happens, it's going to happen again. You'll fall out with the next bunch of guys. And it's about, it's another one about the souring of the magical world they were in. And it's another song about, you might want the Beatles to get back together again, but this is where we are. And a lot of these songs seem to be answering a question when people are saying, when are you guys getting back together again? When's it going to happen again? You've only broken up for a bit, surely. And he's saying, no, it's not nice. Walk a mile in my shoes and know that this has been spoiled.
All of these songs about litigious issues or whatever tend to have a really jaunty... I mean, this was based on a square dance. And you think he did... Yeah, again, the David Bromberg one is a very lively one. And he wrote one for Ringo called Sunshine, Life for Me, Sail Away Raymond, which was basically saying, phew, that's that particular court case over. But they're all very upbeat,
yeah,
musically.
Yeah.
And very bitter, you know.
Yeah, there's bitterness in these, and it's good. I think he's a cynical and difficult and spiky man, and that's interesting. I think, and I think that again, you're comparing it to the solo Beatles things. John has got so bitter and is so aggressive. I find some of Lennon's stuff hard to listen to now. It's not really what I'm in the mood for, the abrasiveness of it. Whereas what I love about, and McCartney is deliberately trying to be an entertainer, trying to keep a chipper face, a really good thing to be doing as well, like keep producing great throwaway fun pop. Mm. And George is somewhere in the middle of them, I think. I'm trying to be bitter, but also still with these lovely tunes and upbeat songs and having pop hits and topping the charts with it.
So we move on to track 3, which was originally intended for Cilla Black. It's The Light That Has Lighted the World.
Yeah, this sounds a bit Mind Gamesy as it starts up. It's got a very...
Yeah.
This feels like it's the Lennon band. And again, it's so nice when they cement into each other and you go, oh, actually, you're still walking in parallel sometimes. This is a nice song. And it's, again, it feels a bit post-Beatles breakup. I know it's probably not meant to be about that light, but there is a feeling of sort of regret and moving on, and maybe the Beatles were the light that lighted the world, and you've now got to sort of face up and move on. It sounds brokenhearted, and I think that it's interesting that Where All Things Must Pass is a lot of leftover material from the Beatles years. This stuff, I think, with only one exception, is pretty much written the year before it gets recorded. So this is how he was feeling, and this is a sad, heartbreaking song, and a nice, again, another nice sounding song. The acoustic guitars are so beautifully recorded on this one. They're delicate and they sit on top of the piano and they just, you can hear every finger movement and string on them.
Yeah.
A lot of this record is a man who really likes his instrument, who likes the guitar, and it's a lovely 70s guitar record. It sounds great.
Yeah. Well, I think it does a verse and a chorus, then it's straight into a solo. And it's beautiful. It's, yeah, again, Nicky Hopkins is kind of doing his Jealous Guy piano. So straight into that piano solo. Then you've got George doing a kind of Dear Prudence acoustic guitar in the background. Then straight into a slide, then a bit more piano. And they're like reveling in them. They're obviously loving the sound of the music.
Yeah.
And it's just such a beautiful sound.
Yeah, it's another...
And they're not afraid to keep going.
He sets out his stall with While My Guitar Gently Weeps, saying that I'm going to do these songs where guitars weep. That's my thing. I'm going to do things where the emotion comes through my fingers, not necessarily through my voice or through my lyrics, which he's in good voice on this record. It's a nice sounding record. But a lot of the expression is coming through his fingers and through the way he's recording his guitars. And it's that lovely feeling of those photos you see of a room full of guitars on these 70s records. You can hear all of them. They're playing all of them. And without ever being rockist. Again, it's a very un-rockist record, and I love that about it.
And again, it plays what we were saying earlier about the anticipation for this album. His huge success, more than Paul and John in some respects, and Ringo. So it's probably George and Ringo were the most successful Beatles in the first couple of years, which is quite...
That's mad.
...surreal. But he was saying it's about the public and the media, their reluctance to accept change.
Yes.
He's saying, I've heard some people have said that I've changed, that I'm not what I was, how it really is a shame. So he's very uncomfortable with this success.
Yeah. And it's saying, will you let me move on? There are two or three songs, maybe more than that, on this record with the same sentiment, saying, I'm going to move on. This is me moving on. And probably if you were in the Beatles, the message you have to send to the world is, you're going to have to let me move on, because this was a few years. eight years. You've got to let me move on. We're now how many years past it, and we're going to carry on. And yet we're talking about him still as a Beatle now. But it's you can't shrug that off. But I think it's about, at least they're talking about it. At least he's addressing it. He's not ignoring it. And the message is to the world, I'm going to just... He's not done what John did, which is hide away and not do any music. He's making music about how this feels, and he's expressing it. And part of how this feels is, I feel trapped by my past and by the expectations on me, and I want to move on.
So move on to track 4, which was originally scheduled to be the follow-up single to Give Me Love, but it was cancelled. It's Don't Let Me Wait Too Long.
This is good. It's so good. I'm sorry, I'm just going to say that. It's so good.
It is.
It's under 3 minutes. It's so small. And again, it was a perfect follow-up single. It's Strum and Slide. It opens up, it's a big busker strum, and the slide guitar comes in, and you go, oh, one of those. It's got a sort of Fleetwood Mac Tusk vibe about it, that kind of intimate rock excess thing about it. It could go on the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. It's someone used this in a film. It's brilliant. It's, again, really simple, deceptively simple. And just it's all down to that sound that he got, that strum and slide sound. It's on, what's that great thing when he does some Rutland Weekend Television, he does the Pirates song. And he comes on and he starts playing the intro to My Sweet Lord, and it's strum and slide, and all you want to hear is more of that. And then he turns to the Pirate song. The joke is he's stopped you hearing more of that lovely sound, because he's patented a noise. It's brilliant.
Yes, what a noise it was.
Oh, the other thing on this instrumentation wise, this guy, which you're not expecting to come into this, is timpani. There's kettle drums or big toms on it, like Every Little Thing off Beatles for Sale. That little thing where you've got a really simple arrangement, but you only go boom, 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 boom. And, oh, that sounds good. This, again, reminds you, weirdly, he's saying, can I move on from the Beatles? But here's all the tricks I learned in the Beatles. This is a song that could have been on Help. It's just lovely.
He said he was trying to write something the Brill Building writers would write. So I think it's a lot of Goffin and King, and, again, the boom, boom bit of Phil Spector. But, thrown in there, but it's such an uplifting song.
He's borrowed that from Phil Spector, but I love that on this, and I find it just cut from a very lazy cloth on Phil Spector, because he's always doing it, because it only happens once on this. It's not Brunino once said that arrangement is something stopping playing, and I think that's just for Phil Spector, because nothing stops. And of course I love the great Phil Spector productions. It's always on at Christmas, I get it, but I find the reverence for that racket that people have, whether it's Paul McCartney or Brian Wilson or something, I go, it's just everything playing at once. It's just excess. It's bombast. It's Jerry Bruckheimer. It's a big blockbuster. And I just, that's tiring, isn't it? On this, there's two tom beats. That's all you need. And I'm just, I'm up.
Boom, boom.
I'm happy. That's all you need. No more than that. What this is taste. Taste.
If only George had spoken to him a few years ago.
Well, he said, I was watching on the Scorsese thing, there's a brilliant moment where they interview George in the, possibly in the 80s, and he said, oh, well, I heard the first mix of Wah Wah off All Things Must Pass. Phil gave it to me, and I went, Phil, this is terrible. This sounds awful. Do you know how much work we did to balance to rehearse the band so we could balance the guitars and coming in and out? And you can't hear any of it. He said, no, I've sort of learned to like it now. And you go, God, you should listen to your own judgment. Because George was disappointed with the Wall of Sound when he heard Phil doing it on his... Because I think he wanted it to sound more like this. More delicate, more arranged, more careful.
Yeah.
He's a Beatle, for God's sake. He knows how to be tasteful and minimal and small. And for an instrument to come in and a flute have a bar, That's what you learn by working with the Beatles and working with George Martin and working on 8-track and 4-track. That's his apprenticeship. It's weird him then going to that massive all the faders open approach, which was fashionable, but now I think it's vulgar, isn't it? It's just really vulgar.
It'd be interesting to hear the new remix that's on its way, see what they've done.
Yeah, obviously it's great. It's a good album, but yeah, I find it hard to love.
Track 5, Who Can See It? And again, where it's more of George's uneasy feelings towards the Beatles' legacy and the fame, which never really sat easy with him at all.
Yeah, this is a nice song. You mentioned Jealous Guy earlier on, but my brain immediately went to the Roxy version. There's a lot of Roxy musicness on this record. It feels nicely 1973. It feels very of its time. And there's a lot of sort of, again, it's the mid-paced descending chords, very European chanson, slightly Brian Ferry-ish, chorused guitars over a lovely agile bass line. It's very sort of mid-period Roxy. And I like that on this. It's got lots of the 70s rock that I really like. And yeah, that very slight Leslie chorus that was on Abbey Road is on a lot of the electric guitars on this. And that sounds very... very Phil Manzanera, very, very Roxy-ish, because his guitars were always slightly treated. I love the sound of this record and this song as well. And it's got the pushes in it, and it gets to... Oh. It starts... And every push, every slight offbeat push says, I was in the bloody Beatles. I know how to bloody do this. When I've written a really simple chord progression, I know that what you need to do is work it and work out where the pushes and the accents are and then give it to Ringo or Jim Keltner and they'll bring them out. And it's constantly limping and pulling backwards and forwards. So again, a simple song is given a craftsman's songwriter's toolkit of pushes and pulls to make the beat come and go, and it moves a lot. It's lovely. And again, the sentiment, I've had my share of this world, my life belongs to me, is a beautiful thing to say, and my love belongs to who can see it. And that's, I mean, is that a bitter thing against the rest of the Beatles, as in, I'll love you if you can see me, if you can even know I'm here, or is it to addressed to God? They all might be that. But yeah, him just saying, my life belongs to me. What an incredible thing to say when his life had belonged to the public or to Paul and John, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, it's almost a Roy Orbison level drama.
Yes.
And tension.
Yeah, I like that.
In this song.
Yeah, he's not afraid in this to play a little bit sort of chanson over the top. Yeah, it's almost... camp levels of sort of Scott Walker melancholy on some of them. And I quite like that. He's a shy man. That must have taken something to be a bit overdramatic. So it's good.
His vocals on this are astonishing. There's different opinions on this album, again, from usually 1970s critics, that his voice was quite weak. It's not as strong as it was, but it's still, I think, the vocal on this is astonishing, especially in the last chorus is...
Yeah,
really going for it.
He was aware that he's out there as well. He's still touring and doing shows and things around this period, and he's aware that his voice is not the strongest of the three front men of the Beatles. He's a backing vocal guy, but he's really giving it some. And this is again this record is him. It's his voice, and his voice includes the instrumentation and the guitar playing. This is what George Harrison music sounds like. And I think there's a funny thing where when people say, what does George Harrison music sound like? It sounds Indian. And you go, no. This, all of it, the mid-paced rock, the descending chords, the bluesy bits, the I said the lack of bluesy bits. He's not a very bluesy guitarist. He's more of a Chet Atkins country guitarist. His scales are far more. He doesn't normally just play. Yeah. He doesn't just play pentatonic scales. He plays interesting scales. He does pushes and pulls. He's very brill building. This is all the stuff he likes. If you want to hear George Harrison music, it's this record.
And we end side one with the title track, Living in the Material World.
Yeah, this is good, isn't it? It's a little shuffle boogie, a bit Get Back. Yeah. And it's about the Beatles. Again, it is a lovely... Yeah. If you like songs about the Beatles, and we all like songs about the Beatles, it's a song about the Beatles from inside the Beatles. It's great. And he's had everything. He's had power and wealth and things like that, and now he's looking back on it and telling the story of his life. It's a sort of... It's an In My Life, but about what it was like to be inside and outside the Beatles. I think he's aware of the slight hypocrisy of saying, I'm not outside the material world, I'm caught up in it. But I've definitely lived through it. I've had all the temptations. Oh, the gatefold of the record's got that astonishing image of them all having what looks like the Last Supper on the grounds of Friar Park. And in the background is the chauffeur-driven Rolls Royce and everything. That's the joke. The joke is... Yeah. If you want someone to tell you what it's like inside and outside the material world, you need someone who's been right up against all those temptations and things. And it's full of lovely puns. I like the pun, the middle pun in it. About how he, with the band all name checked, with John and Paul here in the material world, though we started out quite poor, we got Richie on the tour, and the rich Richie thing is lovely, and got caught up in the material world. That's the whole story of the Beatles. Yeah. Where basically we started out quite poor, we were just a bunch of mates, we picked up our mate Ringo, and on the way we got really, really rich and were completely corrupted and ruined by excess and wealth and fame. And then when he says Richie, Ringo gives you a lovely little Ringo solo that reminds you that, hey, his mate's here. And that, it's lovely. Yeah. So that there's no...
He actually plays the back off Boogaloo drum.
It's just brilliant.
Which is super.
Just drop it in. And again, it's playful and it's... I suppose what all you're being asked if you're George Harrison is, when are you guys getting back together again? And the answer is just then when Ringo and me played together. That's what you're going to get when we are in the mood. Me and my mates are going to jam and it'll be fun. But we're not going to do a concert on Everest. What could we do? This is what you get. You get a lovely jaunty song where I tell you what it was like to be inside the Beatles. And this is a great tune. And it shuffles and it's, they're clearly having fun playing this. It sounds like a fun record to play. Yeah.
We've got Ringo and Jim Keltner playing dual drums.
Again.
So again, that bit you were talking about, the fact that Jim Keltner would stop and let Ringo do his solo after he'd sung about Richie.
Which again is...
I love the image of that.
Ringo and Keltner as a twosome is, again, the Nielsen setup. Nielsen, it's on Pussycats, it's what Lennon produced with the two of them playing together. They play brilliantly together and it just gives you this really big thumps. And they're similar drummers, so they complement each other so beautifully. It's great. Yeah, and there's a little Indian middle eight that he does twice because he loves it, which is sort of goes up into the sky. Yeah. It's the first bit of Indian music he's done in God knows how long, isn't it? Basically, he's not done that since Wonderwall or something.
Yeah.
So basically a little bit of that to go, this is the Beatles that you remember me from, but this is also representing me transcending the material world to go somewhere else. And, hey, it sounds good, doesn't it? That's all right as well. It's again, very expressive, very open, very clever. It's a witty little song, that one. It's good.
Yeah, lyrically and musically, it's combined. You think he used to do Within You, Without You, or The Inner Light as separate entities.
Yeah.
Then he'd do While My Guitar Gently Weeps. The whole point of the lyrics on this song, musically, he's doing that again. He's just mixing the two together.
He's fusing them together in one song, which is, again, he's not separating them. He's trying to say, I'm trying to get both these sides of my life to line up, and I'll do it over a sort of a boogie shuffle. It's great.
Yeah.
So we flip over to side two, and we start with The Lord Loves the One That Loves the Lords.
I sometimes play this record the other way around. I sometimes start on side two, and it's great. It doesn't matter which way you turn this record over. I like the second side so much, I sometimes want to hear that side more than side one. And if you start the record with The Lord Loves the One, it's a great opening track as well. I love that about opening side two tracks. They've got to be good as well.
Yeah.
And it's good. This is very Nilsson-esque. Totally that. And again, the spiritual stuff in this is welded to rock and roll. When he says Lord in this, it feels a bit gospel-y, a bit roots rock, a bit where rock and roll came from. It feels a bit more... it doesn't... I'm always surprised. This got slagged off, this record, for being sort of sententiously kind of religious and preachy and things. But I don't feel the God stuff gets in the way at all. It always feels gospel-y. It always feels like a sort of... It's more of a good golly Miss Molly than a more of an oh Lord than an oh Lord. And this is a great example of that. This is a song about God and your relationship with God, but with sort of slightly sour Harrison lyrics. The Lord helps the one who helps himself. Like sort of those kind of sentiments in it, going, maybe it's not as spiritual as it sounds. And then also...
It's almost something Boris Johnson would tell you.
Yeah, the sort of slightly Toryish thing of going, well, you've got to get... Which obviously, Harrison was always good at doing. So I'm going to open your mind up to this, but also, yeah, you need to buck your ideas up, mate, and get on your bike. The two sides of Georgia in this. But it's also got the whatever you do is going to come right back on you, which is like a sour version of the end of Abbey Road, as in, like, yeah, there's he likes karma, and he likes the people who have done him wrong and have done wrong to the world will get their comeuppance. So again, he is a dark horse. He's got a bite to him and some evil. And if you're, I don't know what your tastes are in solo Beatle, but sometimes Macca can be too saccharine and too happy, and sometimes Lennon can be too abrasive and too angry. And I like this middle ground where it's upbeat and he's having a nice time, but also he's a bitter bugger as well.
Yeah, well, you can see lots of that in the anthology footage.
Yeah.
Where the three of them are together. And there's just a few moments where whenever Paul's speaking and the three of them are there, I just can't help but watch George. There's all these little facial tics and
it's like
just a hint of that.
George has got everyone's number, hasn't he? He's one of the people who just watches, and you get the one of the things that Paul finds problematic with George is George knows how Paul works. And it was not going to work on him. And that cynicism, but allied to an enormous openness to spiritual questing. So basically, he's both things. He's open-minded and incredibly passive-aggressive and sarcastic. this is a good one of those songs. Remember,
next we have The Dreamlike Meditation of Be Here Now, which is a hauntingly beautiful song written in LA in 71 while George was working on the soundtrack to the Ravi Shankar documentary Raga.
This is the reason I have this record. This is what I heard and went, bloody hell, where's anyone been hiding this record? This is a masterpiece. This is just, I think, the best thing on the record, the best sounding thing on the record, the cleverest thing on this record. The rest of the record is a really, really good 70s rock record by someone at the peak of their powers. This is something transcendent. This is, if at any point in your life you've ever thought that Long, Long, Long is the best thing on the White Album, which is something that occurs to people occasionally, it occurred to me, I went, wow, actually, yeah, I'd not heard that before. This is an equal song to anything George did in the drone idiom. And it's not a drone. It's got great chords. But you'd hear it casually and go, that's one of George's drones. You could play it on an Indian harmonium. The great thing about this is I can't express why this is so beautiful, except that it is just clearly a beautiful, beautiful recording of a beautiful song. and a song about nostalgia and living in the moment. It's philosophically deep and interesting. And the lovely sentiment, the past is not what it was before. Again, I've left the Beatles, stop harking backwards. And also, in your life, don't look backwards. Don't look forwards. Be here now. A proper sentiment, a proper adult sentiment. I was listening to the lovely Neil Innes documentary that Laura Grimshaw made for BBC Four, with Diane Morgan presenting it. And Neil Innes' widow, Yvonne, said that the best thing about Neil Innes is that he lived in the moment. And that made being married to him really easy. No regret, no worry about the future, just living in the moment. And I heard that and went, oh God, if I could wish for anything, it would be to be able to live like that. And be here now is George wishing for that for himself. Can I live in the moment, not be dragged back to the past, not worry about the future, not worry about what's going to happen to me, be here now. And I think, yeah, maybe especially during lockdown where you're living half an hour at a time, unable to look forwards, unable to plan, and it's sad to regret the things you can't have, this song becomes even more powerful. I just think this is one of my favourite songs by anybody, and it's in the middle of this record, a record that most people don't own, and no one, and people are just going, George Harrison record. This is brilliant. I would like to open a film with this song if someone would give me the rights and I could be bothered to write the rest of the film, but I think it's philosophically and musically just off the charts brilliant. I love this song.
Saying about lockdown as well, I would suggest anybody who's listening to this is having a bad day, just put this song on, shut your eyes and soak it up. It is wonderful.
Yeah, it makes you float. It's got all that stuff that you need. It's the movement within songs is one of the things that there's no sort of word for in musical notation for, but whether things are melodically moving up and down vertically or whether they've got a groove and they're moving horizontally, propelled forwards. And I always said that was the difference between Lennon is a very, very horizontal movement in his songs and McCartney is very, very up and down. His bass is moving up and down. Melodies are moving all the time. And George is brilliant at floating, at just lifting you, at just cushioning you under and lifting you up. That the motion in the best of George's songs is a floating motion, hence the slide. It's just it's like being in a flotation tank. And this song is a Western rock and roll ballad with loads of Indian influence in it. And it's just, again, if you want the fusion of the material world, of the thumping rock and roll and a strumming acoustic guitar and floating, I can't think what it's like. It's just wonderful.
Oh man, I really want to listen to this album again now.
Way back in time, someone said try some, now buy some, I bought some. Oh, oh, oh. After a while, when I tried them, denied them, I opened my eyes and I saw.
Try Some, Buy Some, which was originally a Ronnie Spector single released in 1971, and George replaced her vocals with his.
Yeah, this one, especially, I think maybe because it comes after Be Here Now. For me, if you're going to put a song after Be Here Now, it shouldn't really be one from All Things Must Pass that I don't like. This is by far my least favourite. It's not a bad song. It's my least favourite song on the album. There has to be a least favourite song on a favourite record. But I can hear, it's almost in here to remind you where he came from. And he came from here, and it's bombast, yeah, and it's big. And yeah, good. To be honest, the record needs one of those on there. It can't all be small and delicate for a bit of dynamics. And this record has lots of good dynamics on it. You need, this is the George you knew from All Things Must Pass. And to be honest, I've heard that, and I am bored with it. And it sounds like a Phil Spector production. He gets a credit on the record because there's so much of his stuff in this. But I think standing next to, between the two songs it stands between, which are both lovely George productions, this makes Spector look like a bit of a one-trick pony to me. And I know he's brilliant. I know. But I would rather have the songs either side of this. And if this song fell off the record, I would not be sad. Though it's a good, it's a decent song. But I just, there's a moment in it where just as it's got about as big as it can get, there's the MGM there's the MGM studio harp glissandos, and you go, oh god, yeah, I know you had them in your back pocket. You go, oh god, and you suddenly realise it's all that long and winding road overkill. Again, it feels like it's filled, pumped full of water and rusk and bread and all the stuff to make it seem bigger than it is. And maybe I'm reading too much into it. I read this album by a womanizing man who liked to dodge tax and drive fast cars is slightly feminine. It's delicate and it listens and it's interested in, that's a huge gendering thing, but introversion and quiet and peace. Yeah. And this is braggadocio. This is machismo. This is produced by a man who shot and beat women. And I am probably reading too much into it, but I can hear that kind of, what if you spot I'm just a little man? I'll put all the noise out front. It's just front. And George's vulnerability as a masculine archetype is 100 times more interesting than Phil Spector's bombast. And I wish this song wasn't on the record, but leaving it on the record reminds me what's missing and makes the other songs better. So I'm happy that it's there.
Lyrically, this is the equivalent of George's epiphany. So it's about perceiving God's for the first time amid a world of temptation and drugs. But again, as I was saying, this was recorded originally for Ronnie Spector. It was going to be a comeback. But you can imagine a load of Ronettes fans singing, oh, Ronnie Spector's got a comeback single coming out. And being slightly baffled when they hear this.
Yeah, actually, that's the other thing as well. I think lyrically as well, the themes that are on this are explored, he's been exploring for a couple of years. And I think he does them better on other songs. He's refined that lyrical palette. Again, that's probably a nice thing to say here. The song that's left over, that's been put on this record, sounds like from a slightly less sophisticated man. He's been on a journey, and the rest of the record is the is him further along that road. This is him starting out, or a little bit further back on that road. And it feels, I'd forgotten which one was Phil Spector until I re-listened to it and went, oh god, it's that one, isn't it? You can hear it's a leftover, not just the bombast, but you can hear it's a few years less sophisticated than the rest of this.
I would definitely suggest listening to the Ronnie Spector version. So effectively, this production, this cinematic production, was for a Ronette, a Ronette singer. So all George has done is put the vocals on, but Ronnie Spector, when it does reach that the sheer drama, and Ronnie Spector's whoa, 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 which George doesn't do, that is the one bit that frustrates me. I was like, oh, if only had done that, it would have been perfect. But
Shows up what a different... You can't just put someone else's vocal into something. There are people who sit within this thing. Maybe that's my problem with All Things. Because to be honest, I like lots of Phil Spector's other productions. I think that he doesn't work brilliantly with George. I think George is too delicate and small to work with that kind of bombast. You need a belting diva at the front of it.
Track 10, The Day the World Gets Round. This was written the day after the final concert for the Bangladesh concert. Hang on, can I do that again? Next we have track 10, The Day the World Gets Round, which was written the day after the Bangladesh concert.
This is a lovely song. This is probably my second favourite song on the record, actually. I love this song. I get this and Be Here Now form a lovely little twosome, and some of that's down to the sound. And this is the one, if you want to play a track off this record to someone to say this is what it does, I think this one is the one to play or to listen to first. It opens with this delicacy, these harmonics on the guitar that it's close mic'd, it's intimate. You're right in a tiny, tiny bedroom with him, and he's playing it, and there's almost no air. It's so intimate. You're so close to him. And it gets big. It gets George Martin big. And then comes down at the end of its refrain to this tiny, tiny, tiny tinkling of acoustic guitars. It's just delicate. It's intelligent. It's tasteful. There's a lot of Across the Universe in it, sort of held string notes.
Yes.
And that same sense of yearning and cleverness. And it's about the world getting together as one. It's an all you need is love sentiment. It could have been played at the One World concert. Mm. It's about what we can do together. It's got a feeling the day after Live Aid. It's another Hangover song. Like, you've done this astonishing thing that's never been done before to do something you really believe in. And the next day you're looking at going, the whole world came together to do this good thing. Maybe there's hope for us. But also, with all the cynicism that comes with George, because he's got no faith in humanity at all. The lovely line is, it's such foolishness in man, I want no part. Now, that's pompous as hell. But also, that's him. Him, he's done this thing. He's probably his feeling. His ego is pumped up, and he's obviously aware that's a bad thing, but he wants to just go, I don't want to be part of war and the devastating things that are done to other people. He's dismissing the whole of human folly, but doing it with all this delicacy and this cleverness and things. Yeah, it's everything that's probably wrong with a pompous, religious, spiritual rock LP, but also he does it really, really well. And I think he's allowed to, but I love the sound of this record. And there's bits of it, again, this is a very Nielsen-esque arrangement.
Yeah.
Very Son of Schmielsen. Again, the closeness of the acoustic guitars, which you'll recognise from there. And what's come over from that, I think, because he was on the Son of Schmielsen sessions, what's come over is not only the sound of intimate late night hungover or 4 a.m. hangover playing, but also the fuck you attitude. The you've broken my heart, so fuck you.
Yeah.
That is in George here, and that's what he's got in common with a lot of those guys who worked in, who cross over between music and comedy and things. There's a kind of a nasty fuck you anger at the world that's in George Carlin and the Pythons and things. It feels like he's part of that world. I love George as the properly comedy Beatle, the one who's completely enmeshed with all the comedians and the cynical, satirical side of it. And this has got both hippie sentiments about the world getting together and a little satirical edge saying, you idiots, you absolute idiots, what have you done? And it just sounds blissful, blissful song.
It's still more than relevant today. Most of the previous year had been spent in court, having all these legal battles. But then on the other side, he was producing and editing the film for the concert for Bangladesh, and he was saying, you know, the lyrics were the disappointment that, you know, this humanitarian aid project was actually necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
Because nobody else was doing anything.
Actually, what this feels...
So there's a lot of frustration.
This feels like, if you've ever read Geldof's Is This It? Is that it? Bob Geldof's biography of doing Live Aid, which I remember reading at the time, actually, when it came out. And it's just this feeling of, we had this brilliant idea, it's going to be amazing, and then all it is disappointment, cynicism, how did this happen, the people who got in the way. And the fact that Geldof felt the same way, as in, I feel enormous hope for the world and despair that this was necessary, that a silly rock star has to do this, and also that it's not going to work and that it's going to get compromised. That's all in this. This is, again, it's a hangover after doing a good thing. Day after a charity concert, you're going to be shagged out and elated and disappointed. And it's got that.
Yeah.
This whole record feels like it's got cans on the floor, full ashtrays. It's that vibe.
Love.
And we end with track 11, either written about a woman or a deity, but I'm convinced it's about Patty. That is all.
Yeah, this is a good song, isn't it? Let's be honest, this is just a good song. You finish off, you go, okay, yeah. You had that, someone said brilliantly, you want to get an alien to land on Earth and play them something off Abbey Road. And they go, that's a good song. And you go, yeah, he's the third best songwriter in that band. This is another one of those George going, oh, he's really good, isn't he? This is a classic bit of songwriting. It's crafted. It's got lovely chords, a very Roxy music-esque. You can imagine Ferry doing this quite well. It's a Euro croon kind of vibe to it, and it's coverable. It's a nice set of chords, nice arrangement, and the little triplet feeling to the chorus again, which George is always really good at, the slight change in tempo or changing the feel from 4 to 3. Again, all these songwriting tricks he's learned in the Beatles. He's a good songwriter for hire now. He can write good songs. And to finish off the record and go, look, I'll throw this one away at the end. This is just your finish. And it's a love song. And as you said, you can apply it to a woman and it would work. So whether it is or isn't, doesn't matter. It's a lovely, something-y bit of songwriting. It's great.
Must give a lot of praise to John Barham, who did all the beautiful orchestration and choral arrangements for this. And
yeah. Is this a real choir? I couldn't work out whether there's a choir or a mellotron choir or something, but there's a lovely male choir. It's just filling and fattening the sound out all the way through it. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And this has got beautiful, because again, it's a song, it's an opportunity to show off. It's a good piece of songwriting. But Klaus Voormann's bass on this is lovely, finding notes within it. He's a massively underrated bass player, really tasteful. And a good, him and Jim Keltner as a rhythm section are a songwriter's dream. They find space and never get in the way of the tune. It's just brilliant. Yeah, don't forget, George has had Ringo and Paul as his rhythm section before. So you need to be that good. And these guys are that good.
Yeah. You think how the song actually starts, it kind of emerges. There's no real beginning. It just sort of gradually emerges.
Yeah.
And it's not faded in.
Yeah. That's the band. Again, it's another one of the things that I think is lovely about this record, is it's not showy, it's not aggressive, it's not bombastic, it's not masculine. It doesn't elbow its way into your attention. It's sort of sinewy and smoky and late night, and you can take it on your own terms. You can find these tunes, and they are good tunes. Melodically, he's got loads of ideas on this record. It's not like it lacks pop songs, but they don't jump up in your face. They're subtle. They let you find them. And when it finally unleashes towards the back end of the solo, and George has not been very showy on this record at all, that solo is short, tasteful. It's got a fat Abbey Road fuzz guitar on it. It's melodic. It's everything you like about him as a player. But again, not very long. Doesn't go on for ages. Doesn't jump up. And it's not... What's nice about this record is it's not... Again, compare it to the other Beatles. I suppose it's more of a Ringo record than it is a John or a Paul record, in that it's not eager to either upset you or please you. It's happy to be. And it goes, this is what I like. This is me. I'm pleasing myself and my friends, and we're having a nice time. Do you want to come along and listen to us jam and play some songs? It's not angry with you. It's not desperate that you like it. It's just classy.
And it was later covered by Harry Nilsson and also Andy Williams.
Yeah.
Does a really good version of it, actually.
I, that Andy Williams version, which you mentioned to me, so I listened to it. It tells you, that shows you what a good song it is. I know the Harry version, and it works perfectly. Because, again, it's the same band, same sentiment. And I think this is a good record if you like Harry.
I think throughout all of this shitstorm we've been living through... on a personal note, I've felt strangely numb throughout all of it. And I have to say, this morning was the first time I've actually had a lump in my throat, was listening to this. And it's just, there was one line on it, because he starts off, times I find it hard to say with useless words getting in the way. Silence often says much more than trying to say what's been said before. And then it's just this couplet, that is all I want from you, a smile when I feel blue. And I was like, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
And lost the plot. And
he's good at simplicity.
It's an amazing song.
He's good at simplicity. And some of the critics at the time were sort of saying, oh, lyrically, it's not very advanced. And you went, no, it's not. It's really simple and clear. That's a skill. That's a skill, to not clutter the thing up, to let... It's emotional. This is the sound of a sort of shy, angry man. And he's speaking through... inarticulacy. He's speaking through quietness. He's speaking through silence. He's speaking through his instrument and through really simple words. And yeah, I find this record enormously comforting and really nice to spend time with. Almost more than any other Beatle record, because I think post-Beatle record is that there's always something on a Beatle solo album that's trying too hard, or trying to grab my attention, or trying to say, hey, remember I was great, or remember I could be great, or forget the other guys. And this just seems to be happy to try and find itself, and you can put it on the background. And yeah, I think the first few times I heard it just sounded like a pretty much a load of songs. They were almost indistinguishable. It was a nice sound, and as I've come to love it more, they've become, like it happens with a lot of great records, become individual songs that I like on their own terms. But it's a nice companion, and yeah, it's good late at night and good early in the morning. I love this record. Yes. Good to wash up to. Yeah. That's the highest recommendation you can give anyone's art, isn't
it? Absolutely. Yeah. I think just a quick note on the packaging, which is, you've got your vinyl copy there as well. How beautiful is that? The front, so it's designed by Tom Wilkes. And if you open it up, you can see George's right and left hands, and it's using Kirlian photography, which is a technique that basically shoots a high voltage. So apparently you can see your aura. And so on the front cover, I think George's got a Krishna image on his right hand. And on the back cover, he's got two quarters and a silver dollar. And you also said about the replica of the Last Supper on the inside. But my favourite thing on the back, down the bottom.
Yes, it's beautiful.
If you can see it. Do you know the story?
It just says, Jim Keltner Fan Club. For all information, send a stamped undressed elephant to 5112 Hollywood Boulevard, Hollywood, California. So instead of a George Harrison fan club, he wants Jim Keltner to become enormously famous and deal with all the success.
Well, on the back of Red Rose Speedway, Paul McCartney's album prior to that, you've got the same thing, which came out obviously before this. Yeah. Wings Fun Club. And if you can look on that, you'll see a couple of wings on either side of Jim Keltner. So he's trolling Paul. The original on Red Rose Speedway, Wings Fun Club. For all information, send a stamped addressed envelope to London W14UP, England.
Brilliant.
So George is really trolling Paul.
Also, an interesting question, which is, I suppose, is what's troubling George. Why would you want all that again? The line on the album saying, the only thing now is to go and get a new band. Why would you want to go and get it? Yeah. We had it. We had the most anyone will ever get. All we can do now is wish it on someone else, like a monkey's paw or passing the runes. Jim Keltner can get it. I think Keltner's been interviewed and said it was really annoying to get all this bloody mail through. Okay, so George is saying to someone else, you deal with it. The whole point is what Paul's doing, which is to try and go and get it again, is the last thing I want.
John Morris, thank you so much.
It's been a delight. What a lovely thing to look at again.
Overall, what does this album mean to you? And also, what would you say to people who have been maybe not going to give it a go?
I love this album because it's new to me. So, as in, I've only known it for a few years. And so I keep finding new stuff in it. And again, it's more Beatles. It's something that keeps showing new stuff to me. I think it's a very good friend, this record. It's an interesting record. It's a nice sounding record. If you like music, it has good music on it. But I think I associate it with the feelings that George was trying to express, which is feeling a bit lost, wanting comfort, wanting someone to listen to you, wanting to be seen, wanting to be heard, wishing you could be properly spiritual, wishing you could be here now, wishing you could live in the moment, and the pain and the difficulty of trying to do that when everything's so distracting. I think it's an enormously comforting record. I think it is the most George Harrison record. So if you're interested remotely in what George Harrison was like and what his music was like, this is the one that shows it off undiluted, unproduced. He produced it himself. And I think it's a missing bit of the Beatles jigsaw, that when we're always talking and fascinated by what happened afterwards, people don't talk about this record very much. And I think it has a lot of answers in it if you're a Beatles fan. And even if you're not a Beatles fan, it's a lovely sounding record that comes from the heart, I think. Undiluted, unfussy, intimate. It's a lot of what I love about music. And I'm sort of glad I didn't know it before, because then I can find it new. And yeah, it can be yours, which is sort of brilliant about it. As in, everyone won't keep playing it. You won't hear it on the radio. You're fine.
John Morris, thank you so much, and all the best for the future.
Cheers. That was so nice.